This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue or two from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any books from my comic book collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 134th episode of the Quarter Bin, we're wrapping up our two-episode, four-issue look at the Techno Comics line of comics by looking at two issues featuring works created by the most prolific, and in terms of comic books, well-known Techno Comics creators. We'll be looking at the first and last issues of a series, Neil Gaiman's Technophage 1 and 10, cover dated August 1995 and March 1996, respectively. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this last episode, but that is Techno Comics, TechnoComix. Just to confirm that it was indeed the 90s. But first, a little feedback. I don't think I got to Sir Martin of Grey's comment last time, his comments on episode 132, the issue of All New X-Men. I was buying these issues, and while I enjoyed the character bits, the lack of story momentum eventually had me pack it in. I wonder if that's a Bendis thing. As much as I like his work, I tend to read it in trade where that lack of story movement from issue to issue can be papered over by the fact that you're reading five or six of them at a time. So I'm not sure if that's what was going on, perhaps, Martin, but thank you for that comment. Last time, we talked about Gene Roddenberry's Lost Universe and Isaac Asimov's iBots, and as soon as that episode hit, we heard from Jeremiah Jones Goldstein from comics.blog. Never heard of these, but they sound interesting. Similarly, Herman Lowe of The Long Box of Darkness said the episode sounded intriguing. And Walt from Comic Reviews by Walt was even more concise. Nice. And our old buddy, the co-host of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, Luke Giaconetti, said he remembered Techno as one of the multitude of small press comic publishers he read about in Wizard magazine back in the day. But I know I never read anything by them, and I'm not sure I ever saw one in person. David Ace Gutierrez said he thought that the line had some real promise. And relatively new feedbacker Lizanne Oswald had some thoughts. Impressive podcast. I hadn't read much from Techno Comics. One I did read had George Perez art, and I may have read a Lady Justice issue. Sad to hear that the Roddenberry story wasn't good, but was glad that the iRobot story was better. Can't wait to hear the next one about more from the Techno universe. Thank you, Lizanne. Lizanne, by the way, has a YouTube channel. And reigning Listener of the Year Nathaniel Wayne, speaking of YouTube channels, wrote in on one of the topics we covered last episode. Dear Professor, having never read either of these titles, I'm just going to jump on the nugget of works that carry an author's name after they've passed on. As you noted, it's hardly a new phenomenon, though it does seem to have become more prolific in the last few decades as more franchise originators have passed on, and the estates or publishing corporations who control the rights decide to, quote, continue the legacy, unquote. Obviously, the artistic justification for such a thing is iffy, but from a business perspective, it's a no-brainer. But I need to ask if you're familiar with one specific, amazing case, that of William W. Johnstone. Johnstone has, at present, over 400 published works with over a dozen more announced for future release, and over 250 of these were published after his death in 2004 and continue to carry his name in giant font with a much smaller acknowledgement of J.A. Johnstone as co-author. While the number of publications, both pre- and post-mortem, is certainly higher than most, so far this isn't that far out of the ordinary. However, things have gone a bit further than just continuing to use the name, as the Johnstone family have done quite a bit of active work to obscure the fact that William is in fact dead and has been for a decade and a half. His death was not publicized and wasn't even confirmed for nearly 3 years after it occurred, and that was done in a tiny acknowledgement in the back of a book. The official author website obscures the fact even further. It used to include things like an open letter to fans written by Johnstone, with no notation of the date of the letter or that he'd passed, and always referring to him in present tense, in a way that isn't quite lying, under a picture saying, "William W. Johnstone is pictured here." The site has been redone in recent months after a YouTube video noting all of this went mini-viral. So now, it largely never refers to Johnstone individually and always cites William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone collectively and uses the present tense of we when referring to the author. And additionally, they also appear to obfuscate the fact that J.A. Johnstone is a woman, William's niece, in fact. The current version of the website doesn't appear to ever use she or even her first name, though previous versions did occasionally reference her as Jo, J-O, on one behind-the-scenes page that is actually still searchable on Google. If this is a topic you talk about in class, I'd be interested if you either knew or perhaps know of an even more over-the-top example than the Johnstones, because if one exists, I'd love to hear it. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne, still alive, so far as the records show. Now, thinking about all of this, that particular topic again, reminded me that even living writers pull this trick off. One of my favorite novelists, as a matter of fact, is Stuart Woods, who for the longest time put out a novel every year or so, you know, like regular thriller authors do. But over the last few years, he, quote-unquote, has produced 4 to 5 books per year. And what sets this apart is that there's no reference anywhere to the ghostwriter, something that's on the cover showing with or and. Or sometimes if you dig through the acknowledgments, like you said, Nathaniel, you can often figure it out. But on his books, as far as I've ever been able to tell, there's nothing. I imagine this is all to prep his estate to continue chugging out his thrillers long after he shrugged off this mortal coil. Now, I don't have a problem with ghostwriting, especially if it's disclosed or at least hinted at. And there are ways to do that, like I said, with the with or and notation on the cover. Even if it's in a smaller font, as long as it's there, I'm okay with it. Or again, a mention in the fine print somewhere. Or even a possessive, like Tom Clancy's Op Center. That says that the idea is his, it's his property, but it is a way of saying, at least if you're interested, that he actually didn't write it. Now, I can't remember who this next one was, this next example, but I'm certain that I once literally saw an actual TM notation on the novel admitting that the author's name was simply a registered trademark. That was honest. I give them credit for that. Although, again, I can't remember exactly who that was. Similarly, the TV show Castle, which starred Nathan Fillion as an author, in between seasons of that TV show, the author, quote-unquote, Richard Castle, would produce a novel ostensibly based on the show with characters that were veiled references to characters on the show. And those books were listed as being written by Richard Castle, the fictional character. And on the back, you would see Richard Castle's picture, which was, of course, Nathan Fillion's picture. From what I understood, the books were farmed out to various members of the TV show writing staff. But that's just sort of a veiled rumor. No one's ever actually come forward and confessed to who exactly wrote those books. So again, that's another odd case of the fictionalizing of the author, not just fictionalizing of the work. But then I thought, what's the difference between that? Between, say, a writing team of employed by the ABC studios pumping out a novel a year with a fictional character's name. What's different between that and a comic book artist being credited with producing work that is done by any of the five or six fellows in their studio? My understanding is that manga often works this way, with the named creator taking more of what we would think of here in the West as an executive producer role, where he gives oversight to the artists, maybe does thumbnails, or always draws the lead character, perhaps. It varies, from what I understand, from situation to situation. And then leaving his assistants or apprentices to do the backgrounds or minor characters. It's a topic that I find fascinating, personally. So, thanks for giving me a chance to talk a little bit more about that, Nathaniel. We do have a piece of feedback related to Techno Comics in particular from an insider. But that will be referenced later in the episode. Last episode received social media love from the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Karen from the Sweet Between the Pages blog, where pop culture and food meet. Ed Moore from Teal Productions. Chris Willett. Clinton from Coffee and Comics. And Laurel, aka Mountain Flower One, from the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Thanks to everybody for your support. All right, let's get to the first of our two issues for this episode. Neil Gaiman's Technophage number 1 had a cover price of $1.95, meaning I acquired this book at a very reasonable 87% markdown. The cover by Brian Talbot shows a close-up of our reptilian title character, fangs and claws bared. But you can also see that he's a gentleman, as his jeweled cravat is visible. The scaly green of his skin is also clearly visible, although something is giving it an orange, eerie hue. It's a pretty dramatic cover, actually. The inside cover notes that this is based on a concept created by Neil Gaiman and includes a quote from the Communist Manifesto, of all things. The story in issue 1, Hideous Rex, was written by Rick Veitch with pencils by Brian Talbot and inks and computer colors by Angus McKee. We start in the hellish vats deep beneath the planet Caligul in the heat and the hell of the firebox, where a feller's vital just explodes like a grape on a griddle. They call it alchemy, but when you come right down to it, they're just making steam, using our souls to drive a demon's dream and feed a ravenous rolling nightmare, all in the name of progress. Now back on Earth, businessman Rob Nichols is fighting with his girlfriend about his upcoming business trip. She wants to go with him, but he talks her out of it. He takes the car keys and advises her to take only one of her pills, but it looks like she's going to down a lot more than that. The purpose of Rob's business trip is really just to sweet talk a little old lady into selling her farm to him. He has to lie about being a farmer himself to pull this off. If that old lady catches a whiff of who I really represent, she'll never sell this place. Before she can sell the house, she has to tell Rob about her college-age daughter Claudia, who was reading quietly one evening when an awful light and sound, almost as if a locomotive, were passing right outside the kitchen door. I don't know what they were or why they took her. She wants the next owner to know that story in case Claudia ever comes back. Rob investigates a bit and learns that the daughter did disappear about 40 years ago. After she sells the farm to him, and as he is calling in the bulldozers, Rob wanders about and finds a tiny little microchip in the yard. He calls his boss, Mr. Beaumont, and tells him about this microchip. But it looks old, almost Victorian in a weird way. Yes, it is etched with tiny tubes now that you mention it. It does look like it might have run on steam. He wonders how his boss is familiar with this sort of thing, and is also confused when Beaumont asks him to walk to the back porch. And at that point, a vortex opens behind him, and the same mechanical beings that nabbed Claudia all those years ago do the same to him. Rob lands in Caligul, and his robotic captors report in. A larger golden robot, the other ones were silver, says that he will notify Beaumont. Angered by the betrayal, Rob tries to fight back, but finds himself stripped and deloused, and then auctioned off. It is announced that Mr. Henry Fage, whose company runs the planet, will offer money and alcohol to any woman willing to cohabitate for 7 years with any of the new arrivals. An attractive redhead buys Rob, and they are instantly wed. He empties out his pockets, and she decides that his watch will keep them off the street for a month. And what's this? A steam chip? At this point, he reveals that he knows that she is the missing Claudia. And then she vanishes. Inside Henry Fage's moving castle, the ruler of Caligul is revealed, and he is a big, scaly, green, lizard-like dinosaur, or dinosaur-like lizard, you pick. Either way, he is dressed in an awesome purple robe, with a jeweled cravat at his neck and the occasional slobber from his pointy jaws. While he is honoring one of his manservants for years of service by, well, by having him prepared as a meal for himself, he monologues for us. I sense great potential in this latest prospect that Beaumont has sent over. I think we have the makings of a real monster here. The end. First, before we talk about the specifics of this issue, let's talk about Neil Gaiman's relationship with Techno Comics. He was the most prolific of the celebrity creators. We've mentioned some of the others before, Leonard Nimoy, Gene Roddenberry, Isaac Asimov, but there were a few others as well, novelists John Jakes and Mickey Spillane. But each of these were involved with one story each. Neil Gaiman, on the other hand, began with two comics, the pretty good Lady Justice and the really good Mr. Hero, the Pneumatic Man. Technophage was a character who first appeared in Mr. Hero, making the series a spinoff. And in this world, the Technophage world, there were two miniseries, Wheel of Worlds and Phage Shadow Death, which makes overall a total of 5 different titles, about 55 to 60 individual issues. So again, he was by far the most prolific of the creators, and for context for Gaiman's career, Sandman was close to wrapping up at this point. So he was a real get for Techno. And from what I understand, Gaiman was involved in selecting the writers for these titles and forming the basics of the plot. In TV, they call this breaking the story and then letting those creators do their things. And from what I can tell, Gaiman's stories for Big were the only ones that have ever been reprinted, although it did take a couple decades for that to happen. Do you remember how hard Gaiman fought to wrestle back ownership of the character Angela? I don't know the details of his legal maneuverings in terms of the Techno characters, but I imagine it was pretty similar. Lady Justice, Mr. Hero, and Technophage were all collected and released, I think, by the publisher Paper Cuts. I don't know if he has plans to produce more issues of these titles or seek a TV production deal for them, but it seems that the rights may have reverted back to Gaiman, so it's possible we're not done with these characters. So, what do we think of these characters, or at least what do we think of this issue? The star is the big bad, obviously, Henry Phage, who's also himself called Technophage. He is one classy dude, sort of taking that neo-Victorian version of the vampire, sort of the classy vampire. And although he slobbers a bit over his razor-sharp teeth, that's sort of the vibe he's going for. He obviously holds this world in the palm of his hands, rules out of fear, all of those common bad guy tropes, except that he does, on occasion, eat his loyal subjects. But only when he gets really hungry. So, I mean, you do have to give him a break. He is pretty much just a T-Rex in a fancy suit when it all comes down to it. And Technophage is so evil. I know, how evil is he? He's so evil that he makes the Earth agent, Rob Nichols, seem downright tame by comparison. Lying to get hold of some old lady's land. Dude, that is so pedestrian. I've talked before about how much I like steampunk. And this world, I think, broadly fits into that category. Not so much the glamorous side of top hats and zeppelins, but more the downside, the Dickensian view of the vats and the fires and the exploited underclass, you know, that side of the Victorian era. That's what this book is focusing on. And I didn't say it in the synopsis, but the Phage building is huge and is on huge treads, literally crushing whatever it rides over. So you definitely get that Ebenezer Scrooge with ultimate power sort of vibe from this guy. And given the horrific nature of the story and of the lead villain and of the world, Rick Veitch, pretty good choice of scripter. I know him best of the author of some pretty weird books, like The One. So the combo of dark drama and dark humor that this issue contains, it was handled pretty well. And I like that when we got narration from Caligul, it was from the perspective of a worker in the pits. So we are seeing this from the view of the underclass. And that's an important element, seeing as our title character is at the absolute top of society, to also get the perspective of the world from the bottom of society as well. And I like the mystery aspects of the issue, the interactions between our world and Caligul, the steampunk computer chip, the disappearance of Claudia. I like the tying together of our world and their world, and I think that Veitch's scripting moves us through that crazy world pretty well. There's a 2-page text piece at the end of the issue written by Veitch, which is mostly about a strange dream he had about one day working with Neil Gaiman, and how some aspects of this book came from that dream. And you know how logical and ordered our dreams are. So yeah, that was a strange read. I do want to mention Brian Talbot's art. It's a little cartoony, but your lead character is a walking alligator in a smoking jacket, so maybe a little cartoony is okay. And the computerized coloring? Well, it's certainly a colorful issue, and it's not nearly as hurt the eyes, assaultive, as the colors of some books from the 90s can be. Maybe it's the nature of the paper. I don't know about the sort of the technical aspects of that to know exactly what's happening there. But the book holds up both inside and out. There's definitely some weirdness here, but there's definitely some quality here as well. All right, that covers the first issue of this title. Let's take a break, play a promo, and when we come back, we'll talk about the last issue of this title.
Hello, everyone. My name is Pat, and I'm the host of a new podcast called The Long Box Crusade. A while back, my wife said to me, "Why do you keep buying more comics? I bet you have not even read all the comics you have already." Well, she's right, but let's keep that between you and me. So I took her up on the challenge to read them all. I decided to read my collection of comic books in chronological order by the issue's cover dates. I wanted to relive their adventures and bring back the memories I had of my childhood in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. My collection has been stashed away in over 20 plus long boxes in the basement. I'll leave it up to your imagination as to why I cannot have them on display upstairs, but that's a different story. The Long Box Crusade podcast will be of recaps and reviews of the issues in my collection in a fun and friendly way. You can find the podcast at longboxcrusade.com. I hope you will join me on this crusade to read them all.
And we're back. Neil Gaiman's Technophage number 10 had a cover price of $2.25, meaning I acquired this book at just under an 89% markdown. You will note that there was a 30-cent price increase between issues 1 and 10. I also did want to note that even though we're 9 issues later from the book we just covered in the first half of the episode, we are actually only 7 months later in terms of cover date, from August of one year to March of the next. One of the many ways that Techno was ahead of the times in terms of comic book publishing, perhaps, was that they did actually double ship this title a few months, which I found very surprising. The cover, by Brian Talbot and Angus McKee, shows our dinosaur-ish protagonist observing a silver-gray spirit being rising from the vats, or more precisely, from the graves of people killed in the vats. We see crosses and ankhs and stars of David among the graves. The inside cover of the issue includes the same creator note as the first issue, along with a quote, this time, from Paradise Lost. Millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth unseen, both when we wake and when we sleep. The story in issue 10, The Day God Came from the Machine, was written by Paul Jenkins, who took over the title from Veitch with issue 7. The inside art is by Al Davidson and Ian McKee, who I assume is related to cover artist Angus McKee. We start high above the Phage building, which seems to be plowing through a jungle or a forest setting. And like issue 1, we have some narration. Come close, and I'll tell you what happened the day all of the rules of Caligul were turned upside down. The narrator tells of how a twist in the gears was heard, and the engine howled in protest. And then the whole place went bonkers. At this point, we see a bright blue body appear deep inside the machine, and a whirlwind takes over. We see bodies flying, steel being twisted. They say the industrial machine was plunged into darkness and chaos. The Phage's indestructible framework lay in ruins. And then, hesitantly at first, people started talking. Now, at this moment, Henry Phage himself is involved in a ceremony with people dressed in religious garb, this world's version of nuns and priests, mostly, and he is nonplussed, absolutely refusing, to let minor distractions spoil this otherwise perfect day. This perfect day seems to involve throwing these religious folks into the pits. There is not eternal life, he declares, save that which belongs to Henry Phage. And at this point, we meet an old man who is tied to a pole, his arms above his head. He speaks to the assembled religious folk. There is no escape from this unfortunate reality. But the path that lies beyond death is yours to choose, and there is nothing Mr. Phage can do to divert its course. Phage and some of the assemblage argue a little bit about religion and whether the death in the pits that drives the machine kills just the body, or if it also kills the soul. It was heard in every part of the building, the desperate cries of 100 tortured souls. The engines were silent now, and we had no choice but to listen to the screams. But in the glowing green of the vats, a spark of that bright blue begins to shine. Phage sees it and orders the vats drained. But instead of taking the blue light with it, that blue light, now growing, is all that remains. The old man knows what this is, that it's the path to salvation. The blue light has taken form and it comes crashing into Phage. "No one can hear you," the old man says, not when faced with the enormity of the true power in this universe. The blue light converges into a fluid shape, but humanoid. "You are nothing compared to what we have become." They say you could sense the fear in Henry Phage's heart as he faced the new order. He was truly alone and afraid for the first time in his life. We now turn to one of the workers, who we learn is the narrator. "Everything changed, you see. Since that day, the old lizard's been up top, brooding and working out what to do. Fact is, there ain't much he can do." And we see that there are little sparkles all over the world now of this blue light. It's still a predominantly dark place, but these blue flickers are all about. If you ask me, I reckon the creature left them bits of itself behind as a gift, as a reminder, just to let us know he wasn't alone against the Phage. On the last few pages, the narrator turns to us, addresses us directly as readers. "Here, this is for you. A little piece of hope. I know. There's some would say that ain't much. Just a little piece of hope on a world such as Caligul. But it's a lot more than we ever had before." The end. Okay, let's talk about this issue, but then we'll also talk about the overall series and even to the whole Techno Comics line. By the way, towards the end, the logo is the same, but they're identified as Big Entertainment. That was the name of the larger public corporation that operated Techno Comics. So if you see a book with either of those names, Techno or Big Entertainment, it's all part of the same company, the same line of comics. Now let's just jump to the end, as in the end of this title, and how satisfying it was. Like I said with iBots last issue, Techno must have given their creators enough time to wrap up their stories. I don't know of any of the series that were just left hanging. And this one definitely wrapped up, albeit with a deus ex machina, I think, literally, a deus coming from the machina, as a matter of fact, stopping the machina, the machine. But it certainly did bring a sense of closure. Now, we didn't obviously cover the 8 issues in between these, so there are plot elements, plot details I can't comment on. Things from those middle issues, whether they resolved or not, like in issue 1, our lead character being Rob Nichols and his storyline of finding Claudia. I imagine that resolved earlier, somewhere in those first few issues, as sort of Phage himself took center stage as the lead in the title. But I don't know that for sure. I don't know what Rob's role is. I don't remember that. So that's an assumption that bit of the story wrapped up. But in terms of resolution, of wrapping up thematically, I can certainly speak to that. And that was definitely done here. Issue 1 was loaded with despair, with fear, etc. And this one ended with hope. So in terms of that big picture, again, those thematic things, there certainly was satisfying resolution. Now, when you're putting a villain at the heart of your story, resolution can be a difficult proposition. And I'm not talking about the more complex characters like Magneto or Namor, who sometimes end up in the gray more than pure black. Or, of course, I'm not talking about misunderstood antiheroes like Doom. That's not Phage. He is not a character you're meant to feel sorry for, who you're to identify with. He is pure black-hearted. He's a villain. He likes to eat humans, just to remind you that he's not on your side. You shouldn't be on his. So you do really want to see his downfall, and that is delivered to us here in the issue. And it's cathartic. It's good to see. It's not a happy ending for the title character. But for the reader, and for the other characters in the book, it does seem to be that. Now, I wanted to talk a bit here about Techno Comics in general, and one piece of feedback we got really allows me to do that. Because we heard from veteran comic book writer Christopher Mills. Now, currently, as I discussed on a recent comics reading journal, Mills is running Atomic Pulp Press. and produces new comics featuring old-timey characters in the public domain. But Mills also wrote the Primordials title for Techno Comics, which I covered way back in episode 23, and he also served as an editor for the Techno line for most of its existence. And he had thoughts, some reminiscences about his time working at the company. It's always interesting to find any commentary on the Techno Comics titles at this late date. Your reviews were well expressed and dead on point. Yes, the quality of the books varied a bit. The company was a chaotic place to work, with creative and business demands often contradicting each other and generating tensions that were impossible to resolve. The editorial department was comprised of some of the most talented, knowledgeable, and comic-loving individuals I've ever had the honor to work with. Unfortunately, the corporate powers that be had no understanding of nor interest in the medium and were only interested in building their own personal fortunes and hopefully exploiting the properties, film, TV, and other licensing, which they failed miserably at because they never understood the value of carefully developing the properties through the comics and making said properties appealing to audiences and thus appealing to potential licensors. Let me interrupt Mr. Mills here to mention that while I was putting these two episodes together, I saw a decent number of techno titles in the 50-cent boxes at the used bookstore near the campus where I teach at, Pulp Reality. And on one of those, it was an issue of Mickey Spillane's Mike Danger, I saw this notation on the cover: soon to be a Miramax motion picture. Which does seem to confirm what Mills was saying here, that the priority was to make deals with the characters for movies, TV, toys even, etc. And of course, this movie was never made, and from what I can tell, it was never even close to being made. So the word soon on that cover, soon to be a Miramax motion picture, that statement does not appear to even have been close to the truth. But back to Christopher Mills' email. There were many other random factors that affected the quality of the books as well. Some of the celebrity creators were directly involved in the development of their properties, while others simply took the money and ran without providing any creative guidance. In some cases, we were dealing with the estates of deceased creators who had demands but no directions, and so were not particularly helpful. I don't think it's unfair to say that some of the freelancers hired to write and draw the books didn't feel much, if any, real commitment to the work, correctly understanding that the company wasn't going to be around long, since Techno was paying higher than industry standard rates in the beginning and were basically just trying to make bank while the gravy train lasted. Again, there's a lot in that paragraph, including some of the stuff we talked about with Nathaniel earlier in the episode about deceased creators. The insight that the comic book side of the company was bleeding money, spending too much money, that was news to me. It sounds good for a company to pay above market rates. Think about it. When we hear that about a comics company, we are warmly disposed towards that. But of course, that comes with the risk of overspending, losing money, and not lasting long, which is exactly what happened to Techno. Editorially, Mr. Mills continues, we were never given adequate prep time before titles were launched, and thus were constantly playing catch-up, trying simply to maintain the mandated release schedules. We never had enough time to properly refine and revise scripts or artwork, and a lot of material just got pushed through. We tried, but man, it was disheartening, and trying to elevate the material, accommodating the random whims of the owners, and somehow staying on schedule was nigh impossible. But I don't believe we ever shipped a book late, and I take some small pride in that. You know, seeing the state of comics today, of books not hitting scheduling, you should take a large amount of pride in that, actually. Mills says, I also believe that we did ultimately manage to produce a fair number of quality comic books, despite the less than ideal conditions. And that is a testimony to the hard work and sheer love of comics by most of the editorial staff. We also pioneered some practices that are common today with an in-house digital letterer, and some of the artwork being delivered digitally from the UK, although back then it took special phone lines, and even with those, hours to send and download. At this point, I replied to Christopher and asked about a particular bit of Techno's business plan that had always intrigued me, and that was of distributing books through freestanding kiosks, basically vending machines for comic books, or maybe think Redbox for comics. It's not a bad idea, is it? And there was this company thinking about it, giving it a shot, almost a quarter of a century ago. Now, Mill said that he doesn't have much insight onto those aspects of the company's business ventures. I was plenty occupied just trying to keep books coming out. I know that they did have a couple of working retail kiosks in Florida and one at the Mall of America, and that several licensing deals were supposedly signed, but to my knowledge, nothing ever came out of it, except for putting more money into the pockets of the powers that were. In that regard, at least, I guess they were successful. Looking forward to your Technophage reviews, even though it sounds like you didn't much enjoy your first revisit to the line. Well, first, thank you, Mr. Mills, for taking the time to revisit and share your recollections about that part of your career. I really do appreciate it. And like I said earlier, he is currently doing print-on-demand comics through Atomic Pulp. And second, part of my disappointment last episode was having some pretty high expectations, I think, in retrospect. If I'd gone into those books more clear-eyed or level-headed, more prepared for what I was going to get, I think that would have been demonstrated in my verdict. And I think that adjustment will be demonstrated in my verdict for these books. The verdict on Neil Gaiman's Technophage, 1 in 10. Again, it can be tricky making an out-and-out bad guy your protagonist. There's a fine balance that has to be maintained between keeping readers interested, enjoying the books, but not by rooting for the guy who would love nothing more than to eat all of the readers of the book for lunch. And that's not just an expression. And I think they managed to do that pretty well. Both Rick Veitch and Paul Jenkins are solid comic professionals, and I think both took this idea of Neil Gaiman's and made the best of it. And by that I mean a little bit above average comic book series. These two issues, especially that last one, I have to say, are quarter bin deals. That wraps up our coverage of Neil Gaiman's Technophage 1 and 10, bringing episode 134 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close, which also brings our coverage of Techno Comics on the podcast to a close, putting Techno in the same category as Amalgam, The New Universe Milestone, The Ultraverse, and Vertigo, as lines or worlds that we don't expect to visit again on the show anytime soon. But fear not, there are plenty of dead universe books strewn across the quarter bins, and I think I'll try, I'm not making a promise, but I'll try to cover another of those dead universes sometime in the episode's 140s. Now, next time, well, I can narrow it down to one of two things. I'm hoping that next episode will be our annual episode honoring the official holiday of the Quarter Bin Podcast. That, of course, is Free Comic Book Day. But there is actually a chance that, I know this is shocking, I may miss that day. Now, of course, by the time this comes out, we'll know for sure whether that happened or not. But as of this recording, the very end of April, I don't know yet. We have some family commitments around that time, and it's a little up in the air which shops, if any, I'm going to be able to get to on the 4th. So if that doesn't happen, and we need to forego Free Comic Book Day coverage, we'll just move up the next episode a bit. So hopefully this will be the episode after next, but it might be next. We'll be looking at a couple of issues that wrap up an arc of a very well thought of title from a very small publisher. So whether it's episode 135 or 136, in the next traditional style podcast episode, we'll be looking at Queen and Country, 19 and 20 from Oni Press, cover dated September and October 2003. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, Neil Gaiman, Technocomics, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.